All right, I believe both council have checked in and requested their full time for argument. Mr. Robert Wiegand for appellant and Mr. Bill Warren for appellee. Mr. Wiegand, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Bob Wiegand, and Mr. Disney and I have the privilege of representing Lon Smith & Associates, Inc. and A1 Systems, Inc., DBA, Lon Smith Roofing & Construction, who are the appellants here. Collectively, I'll call them appellants for Lon Smith. We're here on the appeal of a trial court certification of a class of people who entered into contracts with Lon Smith that contained substantially similar language to certain language contained in Mr. Key's contract with Lon Smith. The trial court's order itself that is subject to the appeal here contains mostly conclusions without any supporting data. Although it claims to contain details, it does not. And as each of you are aware, a detailed analysis is required because this court must review the underpinnings for the trial court's decision. The trial court must understand the law relating to each of the class claims and understand and set forth how those claims will be tried. Why? Because a misunderstanding of the law and how those claims will be tried can lead to the improper certification of a class, which is what occurred in this case. I cannot possibly go into every instance where the trial court misunderstood and misapplied the law in my time, so I will attempt to highlight only some of them. I'm not going to recite the elements of Rule 42 because I know each of you have served on panels with class certification issues on appeal. In addition to misunderstanding the law, the trial court made incorrect findings based on no evidence and conclusory statements devoid of any support in the record. As your honors know, if a person seeking class certification satisfies all the elements of Rule 42A, they must then meet one of the criteria set forth in B1, B2, or B3. With respect to B3, they have to show that common issues of fact or law will predominate any trial of the issues in the case. In this case, the court got it wrong. Predominance, as you know, is one of the most stringent requirements for class certification. The Keys claims, although they say it 18 different ways, it boils down to two things. Did the Lon Smith contract language run afoul of Insurance Code Chapter 4102? And two, whether that renders the contract illegal, void, and unenforceable. That's the nut of their case. It's a straightforward matter of contractual and statutory interpretation that will not take up a large amount of the trial court's time in making that decision. It won't predominate. But assuming, for purposes of this argument, that the contract language does constitute Lon Smith holding itself out as a public insurance adjuster without a license and therefore in violation of the statute, what is the remedy? And I believe this is one place where the trial court failed to make a rigorous analysis, and therefore got the answer wrong. The plaintiffs claim that if Lon Smith acted as a public insurance adjuster without a license, each of the class members entitled to a refund of the amounts that they paid to Lon Smith. The defendants claim that that's not accurate.
Are they claiming a refund of the entire amount paid to Lon Smith or amounts paid to Lon Smith in excess, for example, as the Keys, in excess of what was represented they would obtain from the insurance company?
They are seeking a 100% restoration of the funds that were paid by each of the class members to Lon Smith. Our contention is that even if they were entitled to a remedy of a restoration of funds under the DTPA, or if the contract is voidable, that must be accompanied by an offset for the value of what they received. It's the basic tenets of rescission and restitution set forth in the Texas Supreme Court case of Cruz versus Andrews restoration. The offset is necessary to prevent a windfall to the plaintiff. But looking at the trial court's order specifically, the trial court found that if damages are ordered, then the amount owed to each member based on the amount paid to Lon Smith was an issue of law and fact affecting only individualized members. So the trial court recognized that the damages analysis will be an individualized issue But it went on to say that the court could find that evidence on a class-wide basis. And specifically, the court said on page 16 of its order, class-wide evidence will be utilized to establish damages, and it will establish a procedure for reviewing proof of claim forms. The amount of the refund can be obtained from the defendant's records. So the trial court, in making those three findings, concluded that a refund without an offset was the proper remedy if Lon Smith acted as a public insurance adjuster without a license. That is wrong, and it's clearly wrong. We cited numerous cases that show that when a contract is voidable and has been chosen to be voided by the consumer, whether it's the restoration remedy provided for in the DTPA, or if it's a straight voidable contract under 4102.207, it must be accompanied by an offset for the value that they received. If we are correct, and I believe we are, then each one of the class members is going to have to demonstrate the amount they paid, and since we have pled for an offset of the value that each one of them received, we're going to have to go into expert testimony about the value of the roof and the services that Lon Smith provided to each one of them. That is an individualized inquiry that must be done for each proposed class member. That will require a series of mini trials. Assuming that the plaintiffs are correct, and I disagree, but they say at least 3,000 people have entered into these contracts they contend are illegal. We're going to have 3,000 mini trials on damages to determine the value of the offset that Lon Smith is entitled to. The point is not that we're right or they're right. The point is the trial court has to analyze that issue and make that determination in order to properly certify the class.
Mr. Williams.
Yes, sir.
The amount of money that, first off, there it is at least some open question as to whether all of these allegedly 3,000 persons who might fit into the class had insurance.
That's right.
All right. So in terms of those that had insurance, though, it's a simple mathematical calculation to determine what the insurance company paid and what the bill was, isn't it?
It would be a simple mathematical calculation, but two things here. First of all, the plaintiffs are not entitled to recoup money that wasn't paid by them. There's the recent case that came out where the plaintiffs were seeking to undo a Beratrice contract with Ted Lyon's firm, and the fees weren't paid by them. And when they voided the contract because it was Beratrice, the Court of Appeals said, even if we void this contract, you don't get restoration of the money that you didn't pay. If somebody else paid it on your behalf, it would be a windfall to you to get that money. So it would be a simple calculation to determine what was paid, but it wouldn't be a simple calculation to determine what is the value of our offset. And in those instances where there is insurance, the plaintiffs aren't entitled to the money in any event.
Well, the value of your offset is going to be the amount of dollars that you sought to collect or did collect from the parties that who owned the house where the roof was put on.
If the other side would agree to that, I would say absolutely, we'll agree to that right now. Because if the value that we provided was what they paid, then it's a wash, and they're not entitled to any recovery.
Well, my questions are directed at the concern that maybe what we're doing is getting more into the nuts and bolts of what's the proper proof of damages than we are in looking at the question of class action.
Your Honor, I believe that you have to know what is the proper remedy. How is that claim for damages going to be tried? If it's a simple, this is how much we paid and we're entitled to that as a refund, then maybe an individualized claim, the individual nature of the inquiry isn't satisfied.
Yeah.
Or is satisfied. But we don't think that's the case. If they have to show the value of the offset, there can't be a class because those issues would predominate over any others at trial.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay. A second issue that requires individualized inquiry and therefore defeats predominance under B3 relates to their cause of action under the DTPA, wherein they allege that Lon Smith engaged in an unconscionable course of action. 1750A3 of the DTPA provides for recovery caused by an unconscionable action or course of action. The trial court, in its order on page 10, said the issue of whether the contracts are unconscionable for the reasons stated in the live petition, is an is an issue that will predominate at trial. So we agree. Whether it was unconscionable will predominate at trial. But what evidence is going to be necessary to demonstrate unconscionability? We're left to guess what evidence the trial court thinks will be used, because the trial court concluded with, for the reasons set forth in the live petition. But on page 13 of the live petition, they merely assert that there was an unconscionable course of action without setting forth any facts or any prospective evidence that might be used to prove up unconscionability. The trial court's trial plan related to the 1750A3 action is limited to stating that plaintiffs must prove that defendants committed an unconscionable action or course of action. That's simply not satisfactory. You have to look behind the cause of action to show what evidence will be used to prove unconscionability in order to determine if individual issues will predominate. The list of supposed class-wide evidence set forth on page 18 of the order does not address the individualized inquiry necessary to show unconscionability under the DTPA. Three Texas appellate courts have said unconscionability claims involve highly individualized inquiries that are not appropriate for resolution by class action. How much more clear can anyone make it? Individualized inquiries are required for unconscionability and makes it inappropriate for class action resolution. Now, why is that? Because there's a statutory definition of unconscionability that requires an act or practice which, to a consumer's detriment, takes advantage of the lack of knowledge, ability, experience, or capacity of the consumer to a grossly unfair degree. The defendants are allowed to put on evidence of each consumer who is a part of this class, each consumer's knowledge, ability, experience, and capacity. There's no other way that you can protect the defendant's rights to defend against a claim of unconscionability without allowing us to explore each of those issues in front of a jury. So if there were 3,000 people or 500 people or 50 people, we would have the right to ask those questions to determine those issues at trial. Certainly, if you have to look at the damages related to an offset and the individual components of an unconscionability claim with respect to each member, it's going to devolve into a series of mini trials, and those issues, unconscionability and damages, which are individualized inquiries, will predominate at trial over the only real common issue, and that is the contract, does the contract constitute acting as a public insurance adjuster, and what is the remedy if it does? Those two things will not predominate over the issues related to damages and unconscionability.
And let me ask one question, if I may, Mr. Wiegand. What is the impact, too, of a potential plaintiff or a class member not even asserting a claim for unconscionability?
I'm not sure I understand you. That's been certified on that action.
Oh, it has?
Action.
Okay.
Yes, the trial court certified three actions. One was for a DTPA cause of action for unconscionability, a DTPA cause of action under 541 of the insurance code, and for a declaratory judgment action. So one of the claims certified was an unconscionable course of action, which would, by three courts of appeals, have said you can't do that by class action. And they had made it perfectly clear.
And so all of the claimants would have to meet that threshold.
Correct.
To remain in the class.
All of those plaintiffs would have to demonstrate that what we did was unconscionable, not in general, but as it relates to them specifically, as it relates to their knowledge, their experience, their capacity. The Keys argue that the contract is unconscionable as a matter of law, but that argument finds no support in the cases that even they cite and is contradicted by the Milne case, which is the only case cited by any party that addresses whether a contract can be unconscionable as a matter of law. They said no in a DTPA context, and in fact it was also a class action case. In the Milne case, the proposed class representative was trying to say that the defendant practiced law without a license in violation of an injunction, and that was unconscionable as a matter of law. The Milne court said no, you can't do that. There's not one single case in the state of Texas that any party has cited, and the Milne case says there isn't any, that supports the idea that unconscionability can be proven as a matter of law in a DTPA context because there is a statutory definition that shows what you have to prove. The cases they cite relate to somebody trying to prospectively enforce an executory contract that is illegal, to do something that is illegal. Those cases have no bearing on the statutory definition of unconscionability in a DTPA context, and the Milne Court recognized that and said you can't do it. There are a lot of other issues related to the appropriate remedy available to the plaintiffs who void their contracts under 4102.207 and the evidence required to demonstrate unconscionability under the DTPA. And that demonstrates why the trial court cannot misunderstand the law and still get the class certification question right. You cannot answer a question about predominance if you don't know what evidence is going to have to be adduced at trial to prove the damages and the offset and the unconscionability.
Well, I'm sorry.
If the trial court misunderstood the law, isn't the proper remedy then to remand?
I've read your dissent in the Hackett case, Your Honor, and I believe that in this case, the trial court explicitly made findings that these claims are viable. And I believe that in the Hackett case where you wrote the dissent, you wrote that we don't know whether the trial court misunderstood the law, and we need to know that before we can rule on this. I believe in this case, yes, the answer is yes, it should be remanded, but with a finding that the trial court was wrong. In other words, we've cited 15 cases in our brief where, including the Denton County versus Hackett case, where the trial court got the understanding wrong. And the Court of Appeals said, we find, for example, in the Denton County case, there is no cause of action under the Business Organizations Code or the Electric Utilities Code for these things that the plaintiff is alleging. Therefore, trial court, you need to reassess your evaluation of whether certification was proper based on our ruling that there is no cause of action. I believe that's the appropriate remedy in this case, that you should find that the damages are, if there is liability, that the damages need to be offset by the value that was provided to the class members, that unconscionability cannot be proven in a class action circumstance, and send it back to the trial court to say, with these two rulings in mind, do you still think class certification is proper? Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
So,
Mr. Wiggin, your time has expired. It goes by quickly, I know.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right, and Mr. Warren will argue for Appalee. Let's give the Appalees an additional minute, please.
I apologize.
That's all right.
You were answering my question, so I appreciate it.
May it please the court. I'm here with Dustin Fillmore and Chad Fillmore representing the Keefe, Joe and Stacy Keefe. I want to begin briefly by talking about the contract that is at issue here, mostly because of the briefing in the underlying in the appeal. Lon Smith, in its briefing, focuses on one sentence of the contract. That one sentence is to the effect that the homeowner is authorizing Lon Smith Construction to pursue the homeowner's best interest. And it goes throughout that briefing stating that this is what we're relying on. That's not true. There's another sentence in that contract that states that the final price agreed to between the insurance company and Lon Smith shall be the final contract price. That's the problem with these contracts. That clause gives Lon Smith, under the testimony of the president, Lon Smith will negotiate the contract price with the insurance company, and that price is what is going to be paid under the contract. The problem with that is that in 2003, the Texas legislature instituted a series of statutes under Chapter 4102 of the Insurance Code that says that is wrong. That the public policy of the state of Texas is that a public insurance adjuster should be the person making that argument and making that fight with the insurance company as to what the insured deserves, not the roofing company, not the company that's making the repairs. It creates an incredible conflict for the company who's making the repairs to also to be adjusting. It puts the insured's interests at risk, because think about it, the roofing company is not going to be is well disposed to fight for the insured, as an objective public license adjuster would be. The roofing companies, their goal is to get paid, to get a settlement, to reach a deal. And in fact, if you read the testimony of David Cox, the president of Lon Smith Roofing, not only does Lon Smith Roofing consider the insureds their clients, they consider the insurance companies their clients, which underscores the problem here. And that's why when the legislature passed 4102, not only did they say that to adjust a claim with an insurance company, you have to have a license. You have to be allowed to do so by the state of Texas. If you do that, if you act in this conflict position, if you act without a license, your contract is subject to be void. And if void, the violating party in this company, Lon Smith, you're not entitled to any any monies for the work that you have done in the past or in the future.
Doesn't 4102-207 just make the contract voidable, not void ab initio?
There are two reasons I disagree with that. One, they could have said voidable, and it doesn't. It simply says it may be voided at the option of the insured. Not the election, but at the option of the insured. And the second reason is simply this. If you look at that statute, you're talking about 4102-207. That refers back to 4102-051. 0.051 talks about or makes it illegal for an insurance company or anybody who's acting, who's adjusting without a license, to hold themselves out as an adjuster. But there are other sections also of 4102 that Lon Smith and candidly other folks are out there violating. And that is, for example, under 4102-158, you cannot adjust the claim and also do the repairs. It's a conflict of interest. And not only is that illegal under this set of statutes, it's criminal. Under 41206, it's every violation is subject to a $2,000 fine and 6 months in jail. And there's a case law in Texas. We've cited the court to, I believe, Amerivac. There's also another case, Jones versus Hanna, from the Waco Court of Appeals. This is if a party voluntarily enters a contract that is penal, that contract is void, and the party is not going to be entitled to even a quantum merit recovery. There's no offset. So all that we were hearing about a moment ago. Jones versus Hannon. Forgive me, Your Honor. I have the site.
And Merrimack?
Yes. While I'm looking for those, let me continue on and say that that is why all that we heard earlier about how there's going to have to be 3,000 or 6,000 or 9,000, depending upon the number, many trials over damages is simply not true. Under those cases, and I want to get to in a moment the court's opinion in a recent Fifth Circuit case, there is no offset. There's nothing to try. And, for Your Honor, the Amerivac case is 894 Southwest 2nd 15. Jones versus Hanna is 264 Southwest 2nd 133. Amerivac is out of the Houston 14th, and Hanna is out of Waco. But under those cases, and under 207, there is no offset to argue about.
Mr. Warren, I've been mulling a moment your statement about the claim that there was a dual responsibility in terms of the roofing company attempting to represent both the insured and the insurer. Was there any proof, or is there proof, that relates to written agreements between the insurance companies and Lon Smith?
As to written agreements,
it made it an agent, is what I'm talking about.
No. According to the testimony, there was testimony from the David Cox, who's the president of Lon Smith Roofing, that's in the record. It's attached, I believe, as Plaintiff's Exhibit B, that Lon Smith considers insurance companies or clients, and in fact refers to them in internal documents as their clients and provides seminars and certain educational classes for the insurance companies. And that they begin, then that they
but
get referrals.
But they're not, there's nothing that shows that the insurance companies recognize them as an agent.
No, I believe that's correct. Just that they have a close relationship with the insurance companies and refer to them as clients internally. But I do want to refer the court.
I have a question. If, for example, Lon Smith engaged in this negotiation and then hired somebody else, a non-Lon Smith entity, which I'm not clear at this point if A1 is actually affiliated with Lon Smith or if A1 was a whole separate entity that Lon Smith then hired to do the roofing after it negotiated the contracts with the insureds.
Well, to that point, I believe A1 is the name of the company, and Lon Smith Roofing Construction is their DBA. I believe that's how.
Okay, because it seems to me like there's a distinction between the cases that you cite in your brief of appellees where it involves an attorney who was a non-attorney who was practicing law and was required to forfeit his fee, as well as the real estate broker who or person who got a real estate commission and was unlicensed to obtain such a commission, and that was also disgorged, versus if Lon Smith is negotiating as an insurance adjuster, and that is in fact illegal and precluded under 4102.207, that's not what the compensation is for. They're not being compensated for negotiating as an insurance company. They're being compensated for the roofing. And so isn't that a distinction in the damages here?
The reason I would disagree with that is because the compensation they would never even get to but for their acting as an adjuster. Because under the contract, what they get is what they negotiate. And it's not just, and forgive me, I should have mentioned this earlier, it's not just me who's saying that. To this point, there have been several judges in this county and in the Fifth Circuit that have so far agreed with our interpretation. Mm-hmm. That this contract violates 4102 and is therefore illegal, unenforceable, and void. Most recent was Justice of the Peace Gary Ritchie here in Tarrant County. In another case involving, granted, another roofing contractor, but I believe the judgment's in the record, Don Cosby, Judge Don Cosby reached a similar notion. The first ruling was from Magistrate Jeff Curtin here in Fort Worth, who made that decision with respect to a Lon Smith contract. In fact, I believe the precursor to the one we're on here today, that included, that it had that same language, especially that same sentence about how the final contract price is what's going to be agreed to between the insurance company and Lon Smith. And that decision, which was based on a 12C motion, was appealed to the Fifth Circuit, where Justice Reese Barksdale, Edith, I believe, Brown Clement, and former Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen, in a per curiam opinion, affirmed. So far, it's not just us who's saying this. There are six other judges in both state, county, and federal levels who have said you're right, that this contract violates 4102 and is therefore illegal and unenforceable.
A second question. I'm sorry, Judge, were you through?
I was just going to say, assuming all that is correct, the question then is the damages, and how do the damages not come down to individual proof for each individual class action claimant?
The reason is simply this, because what we've pled, and this is, and I'm going to take Mr. Wiggin on head on here, under what we've pled and under the statute, and in the recent case of Russell Wendt versus 24-Hour Fitness, and this is actually an opinion that was rendered April 13, 2016 from the Fifth Circuit. So I do not have a site other than it is case number 15-10309. The court's opinion in Riles, which is the opinion where Magistrate Curtin first made the decision about the effect of 4102 on the contracts and the damages, it cites that opinion as an example of when a statute, a state statute, does not allow for or requires all purchase money to be refunded in the event of an illegality. What it states is, and I'm going to paraphrase up to the proper clause. They state on page 5 of the written opinion, Texas case law permits a plaintiff to recover the purchase price he paid under a void contract, and jumping down to the relevant part, if the statute that renders the contract void explicitly provides that the plaintiff is not liable to pay for any past services rendered by the defendant. And they cite Riles for that opinion. And again, going back to Jones versus Hanna and the Amerivac opinions, they make it very clear that there is no quantum merit, no equitable right to adjust the price, return of the price paid, if it is a penal if the contract violates a penal statute and was voluntarily entered by the defendant, which in this case it was. So both under the statute, under 207, 4102, 207, and in longstanding Texas common law, there is no basis for an offset under this situation, particularly because every contract that was entered is not only illegal, it's criminal. Now,
Mr. Warren, looking at these this circumstance from the viewpoint of the homeowner whose roof is damaged, you're looking at the two sentences that you're quoting, that you're looking at in terms of your class certification, would put the homeowner in the position that the only money they would be out for receiving a new roof or roof repairs would be the cost of their deductible. Because if the second sentence meant Lon Smith's going to look to the insurance company only, then the insurance company would still be entitled to an offset, to a contribution in terms of the deductible from the insured, and that'd be the only money the insured would be out for getting a new roof.
I would agree with you, but I believe it's clear from the statute that that Lon Smith is not entitled to any money for the services rendered, which would include money that the insurance company paid. But secondly, the testimony in the trial court was that the Lon Smith Roofing doesn't get paid directly by the insurance company. The check goes to the insureds, and they negotiate and do what they will, but the money that Lon Smith is paid comes from the insured.
But the contract price would be the amount of money that the insurance company paid to the insured in order to obtain a completed roof.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. I have another question. So as far as damages, is it your contention that the damages have to flow from the DTPA cause of action, or could the damages just flow from the declaration that the contract is void?
It's our position that it flows from a declaration that the contract is void. In fact, with respect to the unconscionability argument, I agree with Mr. Wagon that was one of three bases for certifying the class. But even if unconscionability is not a proper basis for class certification, though I think it is, it would not affect the fact that there is a class certified under the remaining two claims, which include 541 of the violations of 541 insurance code under the DTPA and our declaratory judgment
case. And you believe that damages could stand independently under either of the DEC action or the DTPA 541?
Yes, I do, Judge. And I do want to say, with respect to unconscionability, Mr. Wagon cited the court to the Milne versus Ryan case, and for the proposition that in no case can unconscionability ever be, as a matter of law, a finding for a DTPA violation. What the court said was, for an action to be unconscionable under the DTPA definition as a matter of law in a class action lawsuit, the action would have to be detrimental to every class member, no matter the circumstances presented. Our position in this case is that it is detrimental, no matter the circumstances presented, because what Lon Smith is doing is having the insured sign contracts that are not only illegal, they're criminal. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Mr. Wiegand, rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. We all need to get past the idea of talking about these contracts as being illegal, because that's not what the statute says. What the statute says under 4102.207 is that if you make a contract with a person who is in violation of 4102.051, then the contract is voidable at the option of the insured. It does not make the contract illegal. It does not make it void. ab initio. It's voidable at the option of the insured. The Texas legislature would not let the insured or the consumer at its option enforce an illegal contract. Take, for instance, an example where, let's say, Lon Smith was acting as a public insurance adjuster illegally because they didn't have a license, and the insured wanted to sue Lon Smith for failing to complete the roof after being paid or for defects in the workmanship. Under the Appellee's theories, this is an illegal contract and it is void and can't be enforced by either party. That's the very definition of a void contract. That is not the circumstance that the legislature intended when it said, if you make a contract with a person who is in violation of 4102.051, the person's in violation of the statute, not the contract, because the person, the consumer, can enforce it if they want to. Therefore, it's not unenforceable. It's not void, and it's not illegal. So we need to...
But I think the part of the illegal position comes from 4102.158, the conflict of interest provision.
Your Honor, that statute doesn't even apply. It specifically says a license holder may not adjust a claim and do the work. There's no dispute. Lon Smith is not a license holder. How in the world can a statute that says a license holder can't adjust the claim and do the work, how can that apply to Lon Smith? Their very contention for all of their class claims is that we didn't have a license. That's not pled in their petition. It was only brought up in their appellate brief. It's a ridiculous assertion to say that it's illegal because the statute doesn't say if you hold yourself out as a public insurance adjuster, you can't do the work. It says if a license holder adjusts a claim, they can't also do the work.
I don't see how a party could hold themselves out as a license adjuster and escape the consequences of the statute for doing so.
That's what the statute says. It says a license holder may not do that. Our contention, of course, is that the language in the contract doesn't make us a public insurance adjuster, and we're not acting as a public insurance adjuster. But all of that is beside the point of whether class certification was proper. Mr. Warren spent the vast majority of his time talking about what bad people Lon Smith are and how the contract was illegal. He didn't address predominance, superiority, typicality, commonality, numerosity. He didn't address the factors under 42B1 or 2 regarding whether we would be subject to incompatible standards of conduct if this wasn't a class and we won one and lost one. He didn't address any of those issues because they can't win on the class certification issues. I don't think they can win on whether the contract is illegal and what the remedy is either, regardless of the outcome of the class certification. But he didn't address those issues because he knows that the appellees...
Are you talking about he didn't address them on appeal?
He didn't address them in his argument here today.
I think that's because we were asking questions.
Maybe. Regarding your question about void versus voidable, the question is right on point. The statute clearly makes it voidable at the option of the insured. If it was void, then the homeowner couldn't sue for incomplete or defective work. And that's clearly not the case and not what the statute intended. With respect to the Wendt versus 24-hour fitness case that was recently issued by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, that case does not stand for the proposition that we're not entitled to an offset. Under the SPA Act, in that case, it didn't provide for a refund of the monies. The simple recitation by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals was, this statute provides that the plaintiff is not responsible for any monies paid. It doesn't address whether that's entitled to an offset. They have specifically pled in their petition for restoration. That's the remedy under the DTPA, restoration. So under the restoration theory, the Cruz versus Andrews restoration case clearly says we're entitled to an offset for the restoration remedy under the DTPA. If they're claiming that they're entitled to damages standing alone and apart from the DTPA, then the case law regarding what happens when you have a voidable contract applies, rescission and restitution. And restitution is not a one-way street. It requires that the party seeking restitution give an offset for the value that they received from the purportedly offending party. So no matter which route they take, either under the DTPA or under the case law regarding what happens when you have a voidable contract, we're entitled to an offset. And we've addressed both of those avenues for damages in our brief.
Mr. Wigan, would you address briefly at least the contention that Mr. Warren made that Lon Smith was holding itself out or believed itself to be the representative of the insurance company?
I don't believe the record reflects that. And if I had more words in my brief, I would have pointed
that's
out
okay.
that.
That's okay. That's enough. That's enough. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Wiegand. Thank you, Mr. Warren. We appreciate both of your arguments today, and we appreciate Mr. Disney and Mr. Fillmore being here as well. We also appreciate the extensive briefing by both sides, and your case is now submitted, so you all are excused. We will recess.
All right. Now in recess.